Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and yesterday I got the chance to interview, after the show, General Stanley McChrystal, who was the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan at the beginning of the Obama administration. His memoir, called My Share of the Task, is now out in paperback. You may remember him best for having to resign over criticism of the White House that made it into Rolling Stone magazine. Remember that incident? But yesterday, we didn't talk about that. General McChrystal surprised me a number of times in our conversation, calling for a new draft, for example, and agreeing that the Iraq War may have been one of our nation's biggest foreign policy mistakes ever. I asked General McChrystal if, however he defines victory, he thinks the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have been victories for the United States.
I wouldn't claim either Iraq or Afghanistan have been victories. I think you could argue that changes have been made. In the case of Iraq, changes have been made in the region, and I wouldn't try to say that they are certainly the way we want them to come out. I think Afghanistan is much more complex in that sense. There are certainly 14 million Afghan women who feel like life is better than it was before 9/11. I think that there are a number of children. There are a number of things about Afghanistan that are much, much better than they were. But there are a whole host of challenges for the future.
Do you have a judgment about the Iraq War? We went into a country not involved in 9/11, left 100,000 or more dead, and created the conditions for an al-Qaeda stronghold that's there today, even after you got Zarqawi there, which did not exist under Saddam Hussein, as brutal a dictator as he was. And personally, I wonder if Iraq was one of the biggest foreign policy and U.S. national security mistakes in U.S. history. How do you see it?
I think that's certainly arguable, and I wouldn't fight that assessment. What I would say, when I entered Iraq in the fall of 2003, about 6 months after the invasion, what had happened is in the chaos that ensued, al-Qaeda showed up. So we really had... You can make a judgment on the initial invasion, but by about 2004, al-Qaeda had come into that environment. So then we had a requirement to wage a significant fight against them, which we ultimately did. So, you know, I'll sort of, you know, leave history to judge the invasion decision.
And where is it today in your assessment, Iraq?
I think Iraq's in a very difficult position. The government of Iraq has not been successful in bringing the Sunni minority into feeling like they are part of a fair, pluralistic government. And that's going to cause them increasing problems. It's made much, much worse by the fact that now across the border in Syria, you've got a potentially chaotic state, and it's unclear where Syria will go, whether the Assad regime will fall, and if the opposition win, what combination of opposition elements will take over. I think that portends very great danger for the region because it will be difficult for Iraq between Iran and Syria to have a stable environment. I don't say it's impossible, but it's going to be hard. So I've got great concerns about that part of the world.
Retired General Stanley McChrystal, my guest on WNYC, who was the original commander of our forces in Afghanistan under President Obama. His book, now out in paperback, is My Share of the Task, a memoir. On the topic of drone strikes, General, are you ambivalent? They've become seen as morally questionable because of the difficulty of avoiding accidental killings of civilians. And also, I think, the video game detachment from killing that can come from, you know, a guy sitting in the U.S. somewhere pulling the trigger based on a video screen display. Are you ambivalent about how we're using weaponized drones?
I am. I think that they are an important part of our arsenal, and they'll be used now and in the future and should be. But I think that the 2 points that you mentioned, the first being there's a danger that they seem antiseptic and therefore they might lower the threshold to doing something. There's a danger in that you can do things that you might not otherwise do. And then the last one is, regardless of whether they produce civilian casualties or not, and you try to avoid that, the perception in much of the world is that they do. And there's a perception that while we stand off without putting ourselves at risk, that we might be casual about employing those weapons and producing civilian casualties. And so the mere perception becomes hugely important. And I think that we need to understand that this weapon has a new dynamic, something where we've really not seen before. I can't think of a great parallel. And we need to understand that wars are decided in the minds of people. And so that even though it may operationally or tactically seem like an extraordinarily good weapon, it's certainly got some counter forces that push back against overusing it.
And the drones, I think, are one example of how the U.S. since 9/11 has suffered quite a bit of backlash over some of the ways we fought these wars. Interrogations that many consider torture, the drone attacks with their civilian casualties, setting up Gitmo and international rendition bases to avoid the rule of law as it's widely perceived, assassinations without indictments over capture even of American citizens in rare instances. Have we squandered the moral leadership that we could have had in our response to the morally horrific al-Qaeda attack of 2001?
Well, I wouldn't use the word squander. I would say that, you know, as you go through these things, our countries make mistakes, and we certainly have made mistakes. You think about Abu Ghraib and the effect that that had in motivating thousands of young men from across the region to come and fight jihad in Iraq when they otherwise might not have. And so if it teaches any lesson, and this has been learned historically over and over again, the French in Algeria and other places, as you get into one of these difficult, sometimes termed dirty wars, there's a great requirement not to take that slide, to force yourself to operate with the highest possible moral level, the highest possible legal level. It seems constraining. It seems frustrating. But at the end of the day, I think it's very, very important, because if you lose your credibility and your legitimacy, it's very, very difficult to regain.
How would you grade the United States' performance on that scale since 9/11?
Well, if you take in totality, very, very good. Now, because I saw thousands of young people, young men and women, out, just extraordinary restraint and extraordinary professionalism. However, if you go back and you look at things like Abu Ghraib and others and the perception of things like Guantanamo Bay and whatnot, then it becomes different, because suddenly the grade sheet looks very negative. But people don't see the whole swath of things, and that's one of the points that I think is important. You can be right 9 times out of 10. But if you are perceived as being wrong on that 10th time, people tend to categorize you as wrong. And that's what makes it so hard. The thing about insurgents and terrorists is, if they're good, their entire strategy is designed to make you overreact. Osama bin Laden's stated strategy before 9/11 was to get America to overreact to attack on our homeland. And he thought that that would cause us to enrage the Islamic world and to bankrupt ourselves. And if you think about it, that's a pretty perceptive idea, because he knew he would get a reaction. And that's exactly what happens on the local level as individuals plant improvised explosive devices or do these horrifically gruesome terrorist attacks. They're trying to enrage forces so that they will overreact and that they will do things that make them lose stature in the eyes of the populace.
Stanley McChrystal, retired general, my Share of the Task, a memoir, his book now out in paperback. Your book is called My Share of the Task. Do you think most Americans have not done their share of the task since 9/11, as Americans did say in World War II?
I don't think they have, but I think largely because we haven't been asked to. We went at this set of conflicts with a very professional military that doesn't have a draft, so we haven't gone to the wider populace. We also didn't raise taxes. There are a lot of things we didn't do about our society to put ourselves on a footing that would be the equivalent of war. Now, it wasn't viewed that this was the existential threat that the Second World War was, but I still think we made a mistake, because the degree to which you allow the nation to be separate from something this important, you don't get people's full support. Plus, you might not get the same amount of scrutiny that you really want. One of the things I believe is, if the nation goes to war, every part of America should be at risk, so that America makes a very thoughtful decision before they put any young men or women in harm's way and our national treasure. So I don't think we did it as well this time as we probably should have.
How could we do that, put more Americans at risk, as you put it, without reinstituting the draft, which I presume you would oppose?
No, I would not oppose reinstituting the draft. And it is not because we need more soldiers. Most of my career was spent with a volunteer force, which was superb. But there's a danger that you don't have every neighborhood in America and every part of our economic strata represented. And so I think there's a danger in that. I think that the people who represent America in the United Nations, in diplomacy, in non-government organizations, and on the battlefield, they should represent America. As they say, you should be able to hold a mirror up, and it should be a reflection of the American people. And so I think that that's an important component of how we go about things like war.
I am surprised by your answer. I think that most generals, correct me if I'm wrong, or people of high position in the military of any kind, would say that the quality of the fighting force is so much better when you have people who want to be there as compared to what we had in the Vietnam era with so many people who didn't want to be there, that if there's a way to spread the risk around the population, it should be with something other than the draft. As a military strategist, what would you say about the downside of a draft?
Well, I wouldn't argue that we've had a wonderfully professional military, but we had a draft much before Vietnam. Vietnam, I think, was a special case. We had a draft for Korea, for World War II, for World War I, for the Civil War. And so the idea of people being called to service wasn't anything new. I think Vietnam was an unpopular, long, difficult war and had a lot of challenges that caused it to be worse than other experiences. It's clearly a balance. I mean, having a very professional force gives you levels of ability to operate that are just, you know, enviable by every nation in the world. But at the same time, really what wars are about are extension of national policy. They're not exercises in whether you can produce just the best men's basketball team for the Olympics. It's really about expanding American ideals and whatnot. And therefore, that's why I come down on the idea of we should be as inclusive as we can.
When former Defense Secretary Robert Gates' book came out recently, I asked him if he published a book while President Obama is still in office, because he wants to influence any decisions in particular that the Obama administration still might have to make. He said, that is why. Let me play you his response and get your reaction.
There are a lot of issues relating to war and peace, whether to use military action against Syria, whether to use military action against Iran if the negotiations fail, how to deal with China and Russia and allies such as Israel and Saudi Arabia. All of these are contemporary issues, and having the perspective of having worked for eight presidents, I think what I have to say on those issues, and particularly my cautionary assessments in the book about going to war and about presidents being too quick to reach for a gun, I think have relevance in the current environment.
General McChrystal, how much do you agree with Secretary Gates's basic cautionary assessment about going to war there, and that presidents are too quick to reach for a gun, as he put it?
Yeah, I won't say that presidents are too quick to reach for a gun, but I think that the process to go to war should be very deliberate and very careful. And I think that in many cases, particularly in the cases, understandably in Afghanistan, because we didn't expect that strike, but certainly in the case of Iraq, I don't think we as a nation did our homework. I don't think we understood the situation on the ground in the region to the depth which you'd want to. I sometimes draw a comparison to making a significant investment. You do due diligence, and I just don't think we as a nation did enough due diligence. And so I think the Secretary's cautionary note is very, very appropriate.
Are there decisions that you would like to influence that you anticipate for the remaining years of the Obama administration?
Well, I don't participate in the political world in that sense, but I was hoping that in my book we would look at things like the process to make decisions. They're always hard. I teach this at Yale, and one of the things we study through historical case studies is how hard it is to get the right people in the room, the right information, and to have a very good process to get to a good outcome. And so it's something that if people will study it, good and bad cases, I think it advantages us for the future.
We could do a whole other interview about what you teach in your course on leadership at Yale, but I'll just ask you, do you think the lessons about leadership that you learn as a general at war are applicable only to that, or also to business, or being a mayor, or being a parent?
I think they are remarkably similar. I was actually surprised when I left military service and entered the civilian workforce. The challenges that leaders face from the political sense to companies are remarkably like generals face. And in fact, many of them will tell me, well, my job's not as hard because it's not life and death. But if you are protecting the jobs and health care of your employees, if you're doing that, it's pretty darn important. And so I think that the transference of the lessons is really high.
Starting with any couple of basic principles at the top?
Yeah, I think the first thing is if you are going to lead an organization, you have to empathize with it. When I say empathize, I don't mean sympathize. You must understand inside your organization at every level what situation they are dealing with. It's very easy to get detached from what's happening. And I found in the battlefield, as you become a general, you got to go down routinely down to platoon and squad level, because very quickly you can look at a map and you can see symbols and start to think of it as sort of antiseptic and whatnot. And you get down close, it's not. And the same thing turns out to be true in businesses. So there's a need to have a basic empathy and understanding. And then the other part of it is you've got to communicate constantly. I found that everyone has a view that armies are this very directive entity where the general says everybody goes left and everybody mindlessly turns left. And it's not at all like that. You have got to convince people that going left is the right thing to do and that you've made good decisions and they are confident to do that. And it's the same in business. You've got to communicate not only what you want them to do, but you've got to give them a really good understanding of the logic that took you to that. And then they have buy-in. Then they own the decision. And I found that that's exactly true in the civilian world as well.
Last question. Any reaction to Defense Secretary Hagel's blueprint to have the smallest military since before World War II?
Yeah, my reaction would be we're about to enter a big political wrestling match over this. I think the thing to understand is we're going to be driven by financial reality. There are going to have to be significant defense cuts. And if we come at it that way, we are going to have to make some very tough choices. But if we hamstring ourselves with too much political fighting over this program or that base or whatever, what we'll get is a hodgepodge outcome. I think what we've got to do is take a realistic look what the nation can afford and how much risk we're willing to accept. And then I think we've got to give Secretary Hagel and General Dempsey and others a fair amount of latitude and support so that they can craft a coherent force. Now, there will be things that are eliminated that some people don't like. There will be risks accepted because we don't have quite as many of this or many of that as we'd like. But the reality is that's the history of the nation. We've always had to do that. And so if everybody holds every single program or every single benefit up as a golden ox that can't be gored, I think we won't get a good outcome.
General Stanley McChrystal, former commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. His memoir, My Share of the Task, a memoir now out in paperback. Thank you so much.
Brian, my pleasure. Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, still to come this morning. 6 Google hiring secrets, including ability to learn, which they say is different from IQ, and why Google hires some people with no college degrees. Also, Jad from Radiolab coming up to parse the phrase, neither confirm nor deny. And who shot Gary Melius, the masked gunman mystery surrounding the politically connected Long Island tycoon? Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.